while he slowly pirouettes on the other. Long gyrations, ornamented with spasmodic movements of the hands. Although Tom was usually called an idiot or imbecile, such posturing and stereotypes are more characteristic of autism. But autism was only identified in the 1940s and was not a term or even a concept in the 1860s. Autism clearly is a condition that has always existed, affecting occasional individuals in every period and culture. It has always attracted in the popular mind an amazed, fearful, or bewildered attention, and perhaps engendered mythical or archetypal figures, the alien, the changeling, the child bewitched. It was medically described almost simultaneously in the 1940s by Leo Kanner in Baltimore and Hans Asperger in Vienna. Both of them independently named it autism. Kanner's and Asperger's accounts were in many ways strikingly, at times uncannily similar, a nice example of historical synchronicity. Both emphasized aloneness, mental aloneness, as the cardinal feature of autism. This indeed was why they called it autism. In Kanner's words, this aloneness, whenever possible, disregards, ignores, shuts out anything that comes to the child from the outside. This lack of contact, he felt, was only in regard to people. Objects, by contrast, might be normally enjoyed. The other defining feature of autism, for Kanner, was an obsessive insistence on sameness, in the form of repetitive, stereotyped movements and noises, or stereotypes, most simply, then in the adoption of elaborate rituals and routines, finally in the appearance of strange, narrow preoccupations, highly focused, intense fascinations and fixations. The appearance of such fascinations and the adoption of such rituals, often before the age of 5, were not to be seen, Kanner and Asperger thought, in any other condition. Asperger brought out other striking features, stressing, they do not make eye contact. They seem to take in things with short, peripheral glances. There is a poverty of facial expressions and gestures. The use of language appears abnormal, unnatural. The children follow their own impulses, regardless of the demands of the environment. Singular talents, usually emerging at a very early age and developing with startling speed, appear in about 10% of the autistic, and in a smaller number of the retarded, though many savants are both autistic and retarded. A century before blind Tom, there was Gottfried Mint, a cretinous imbecile born in Bern in 1768, who showed from an early age a striking talent for drawing. He had, according to A.F. Tredgold's classic 1908 textbook of mental deficiency, such a marvelous faculty for drawing pictures of cats that he was known as the Cat's Raphael. But he also made drawings and watercolor sketches of deer, rabbits, bears, and groups of children. He soon acquired fame throughout Europe, and one of his pictures was purchased by George IV. Prodigious calculators attracted attention in the 18th century. Jedediah Buxton, a simple-minded laborer, had perhaps the most tenacious memory of these. When asked what would be the cost of shoeing a horse with 140 nails, if the price was 1 farthing for the first nail, then doubled for each remaining nail, he arrived at the nearly correct figure of 725 decillion, 958 nonillion, 96 octillion, 74 septillion, 907 sextillion, 868 quintillion, 531 quadrillion, 656 trillion, 993 billion, 638 million, 851,106 pounds, 2 shillings and 8 pence. When he was then asked to square this number, that is, 2 to the 139th power squared, he came up with, after 2.5 months, a 78-digit answer. Though some of Buxton's calculations took weeks or months, he was able to work, to hold conversations, to live his life normally while doing them. The prodigious calculations proceeded almost automatically, only throwing their results into consciousness when completed. Child prodigies, of course, are not necessarily retarded or autistic. There have been itinerant calculators of normal intelligence as well. One such was George Parker Bidder, who as a child and youth gave exhibitions in England and Scotland. He could mentally determine the logarithm of any number to 7 or 8 places, and apparently intuitively could divine the factors for any large number. Bidder retained his powers throughout life, and indeed made great use of them in his profession as an engineer, and often tried to delineate the procedures by which he calculated. In this, however, he was unsuccessful. He could only say of his results that they seemed to rise with the rapidity of lightning in his mind, but that their actual operations were largely inaccessible to him. His son, also intellectually gifted, was a natural calculator as well, though not as prodigious. Besides these major domains of savant expertise, some savants have astonishing verbal powers, the last thing one might expect in intellectually defective individuals. Thus there are savants who are able, by the age of 2, to read books and newspapers with the utmost facility, but without the least comprehension. Their expertise, their decoding, is wholly phonological and syntactic, without any sense of meaning. Almost all savants have prodigious powers of memory. Dr. J. Langdon Down, one of the greatest observers in this realm, who coined the term idiot savant in 1887, remarked that extraordinary memory was often associated with very great defect of reasoning power. He describes giving one of his patients Gibbon's Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. The patient had read the entire book and, in a single reading, imprinted it in memory. But he had skipped a line on one page, an error at once detected and corrected. Ever after, Down tells us, when reciting from memory the stately periods of Gibbon, he would, on coming to the third page, skip the line and go back and correct the error with as much regularity as if it had been part of the regular text. Martin A., a savant I wrote about in A Walking Grove, could recall the entire 9 volumes of Grove's 1954 Dictionary of Music and Musicians. This had been read to him by his father, and the text would be replayed in his father's voice. There is a large variety of minor savant skills, frequently described by physicians like Down and Treadgold, who consulted at institutions for the mentally defective. Treadgold describes J.H. Pullen, the genius of Earlswood Asylum, who for more than 50 years made extremely intricate models of ships and machines, as well as a very real guillotine, which almost killed one of his attendants. Treadgold writes of an otherwise retarded savant who could get a complex mechanism like a watch and disassemble and reassemble it swiftly, with no prior instruction. More recently, physicians have described idiot savants with extraordinary bodily skills, able to perform acrobatic maneuvers and athletic feats with the greatest facility, again, with no formal training. In the 1960s, I saw, on a back ward, such a savant myself. He had been described to me as an idiot Nijinsky. While early medical observers sometimes conceived of savant skills as the hypertrophy of a single mental faculty, there was little sense that savant talents were of much more than anecdotal interest. An exception here was the eccentric psychologist F.W.H. Myers, who, in his great turn-of-the-century book, Human Personality, tried to analyze the processes by which prodigious calculators arrived at their results. He was unable to do so, any more than could the calculators themselves. But he believed that a process of subliminal mentation or computation was involved, which threw its results into consciousness when complete. Their methods of calculation seemed to be, unlike the formal or formulary methods taught in primers and schools, idiosyncratic and personal, achieved by each calculator through an individual path. Myers was one of the first to write about unconscious or preconscious cognitive processes, and foresaw that an understanding of idiot savants and their gifts could open not only into a general understanding of the nature of intelligence and talent, but into that vast realm that we now call the cognitive unconscious. In the 1940s, when autism was first delineated, it became evident that the majority of idiot savants were in fact autistic, and that the incidence of savantism in the autistic, nearly 10%, was almost 200 times its incidence in the retarded population, and thousands of times that of the population at large. Furthermore, it became clear that many autistic savants had multiple talents: musical, mnemonic, visual graphic, computational, and so on. In 1977, the psychologist Lorna Self published Nadia, a case of extraordinary drawing ability in an autistic child. Nadia suddenly started drawing at the age of 3.5, rendering horses and later a variety of other subjects in a way that psychologists considered not possible. Her drawings, they felt, were qualitatively different from those of other children. She had a sense of space, an ability to depict appearances and shadows, a sense of perspective such as the most gifted normal child might only develop at 3 times her age. She constantly experimented with different angles and perspectives. Whereas normal children go through a developmental sequence from random scribbling to schematic and geometric figures to tadpole figures, Nadia seemed to bypass these and to move at once into highly recognizable, detailed, representational drawings. The development of drawing in children, it was felt at the time, paralleled the development of conceptual powers and language skills. But Nadia, it seemed, just drew what she saw, without the usual need to understand or interpret it. She not only showed enormous graphic gifts, an unprecedented precocity, but drew in a way that attested to a wholly different mode of perception and mind. The case of Nadia, set out at monographic length and minutely documented, aroused great excitement in the neurological and psychological communities, and suddenly focused a belated attention on savant talents and on the nature of talents and special abilities in general. Where, for a century or more, neurologists had confined their attention to failures and breakdowns of neural function, there was now a move in the other direction, to exploring the structure of heightened powers, of talents, and their biological basis in the brain. Here, idiot savants provided unique opportunities, for they seemed to exhibit a large range of inborn talents, raw, pure expressions of the biological, much less dependent upon or influenced by environmental and cultural factors than the talents of normal people. In June of 1987, I received a large packet from a publisher in England. It was full of drawings, drawings that delighted me greatly because they portrayed many of the landmarks I had grown up with in London. Monumental buildings like St. Paul's, St. Pancras Station, the Albert Hall, the Natural History Museum, and others, odd, sometimes out of the way, but dear and familiar places like the Pagoda in Kew Gardens. They were very accurate, but not in the least mechanical. On the contrary, they were full of energy, spontaneity, oddity, life. In the packet, I discovered a letter from the publisher. The artist, Stephen Wiltshire, was autistic and had shown savant abilities from an early age. His London alphabet, a sequence of 26 drawings, had been done when he was 10. An amazing elevator shaft with a vertiginous perspective when he was 8. One drawing was an imagined scene of St. Paul surrounded by flames in the Great Fire of London. Stephen was not merely a savant, but a prodigy. 60 of his drawings, a mere fraction of what he had done, were to be published, the letter informed me. The author was just 13. Stephen's drawings reminded me in many ways of drawings by my patient Jose, the autist artist whom I had known and written about years before. with an extraordinary eye and gift for drawing. Though Jose and Stephen came from such different backgrounds, the similarity of their drawings was so uncanny as to make me wonder whether there might not be a distinctive autistic form of perception and art. But Jose, despite his fine gifts, not perhaps as great as Stephen's, but quite remarkable nonetheless, was wasting away in a state psychiatric hospital. Stephen had somehow been luckier. A few weeks later, visiting family and friends in England, I mentioned Stephen and his drawings to my brother David, a general practitioner in northwest London. "Stephen Wiltshire," he exclaimed, very startled. "He's a patient of mine. I've known Stephen since he was 3. David told me something of Stephen's background. He was born in London in April of 1974, the second child of a West Indian transit worker and his wife. Unlike his older sister, Annette, born 2 years earlier, Stephen showed some delay in the motor landmarks of infant life. Sitting, standing, hand control, walking, and a resistance to being held. In his second and third years, more problems appeared. He would not play with other children and tended to scream or hide in a corner if they approached. He would not make eye contact with his parents or anyone else. Sometimes he seemed deaf to people's voices, though his hearing was normal, and thunder terrified him. Perhaps most disquieting, he did not use language. He was virtually mute. Just before Stephen's third birthday, his father was killed in a motorcycle accident. Stephen had been strongly attached to him, and after his death grew much more disturbed. He started screaming, rocking, and flapping his hands, and lost what little language he had. At this point, the diagnosis of infantile autism had been made, and arrangements made for him to attend a special school for developmentally disabled children. Lorraine Cole, the headmistress at Queen's Mill, observed that Stephen was very remote when he started school at the age of 4. He seemed unaware of other people and showed no interest in his surroundings. He would simply wander about aimlessly or occasionally run out of the room. As Cole writes, he had virtually no understanding of or interest in the use of language. Other people held no apparent meaning for him except to fulfill some immediate, unspoken need. He used them as objects. He could not tolerate frustration, nor changes in routine or environment, and he responded to any of these with desperate, angry roaring. He had no idea of play, no normal sense of danger, and little motivation to undertake any activity except scribbling. She later wrote to me, "Stephen would climb onto a play bike, pedal it furiously, then hurl himself off it, roaring with laughter and sometimes screaming." Yet at this point, the first evidence of his visual preoccupation and talent appeared. He seemed fascinated by shadows, shapes, angles, and by the age of 5, he was fascinated by pictures, too. He would make sudden dashes to other rooms, where he would stare intently at pictures which fascinated him, Cole writes. He would find paper and pencil and scribble, totally absorbed for long periods. Stephen's scribblings were largely of cars, and occasionally of animals and people. Lorraine Cole speaks of his doing wickedly clever caricatures of some of the teachers. But his special interest, his fixation which developed when he was 7, was the drawing of buildings. Buildings in London he had seen on school trips, or that he had seen on television or in magazines. Why he developed this sudden special interest and preoccupation so powerful and exclusive that he now had no impulse to draw anything else is not wholly clear. Such fixations are exceedingly common in autistic people. Jesse Park, an autistic artist, is obsessed with weather anomalies and constellations in the night sky. Shiochiro Yamamura, an autistic artist in Japan, drew insects almost exclusively. And Johnny, an autistic boy described by the pioneer psychologist Mira Rothenberg for a period, drew only electric lamps or buildings and people composed of electric lamps. Stephen, from this very early age, had been almost exclusively preoccupied with buildings. Buildings, by preference, of great complexity and size, and also with aerial views and extremities of perspective. He had one other interest at the age of 7. He was fascinated by sudden calamities, and above all by earthquakes. Whenever Stephen drew these or saw them on television or in magazines, he grew strangely excited and overwrought. Nothing else disturbed him in quite this way. One wonders whether his earthquake obsession, like the apocalyptic fantasies of some psychotics, represented a sense of his own inner instability, which in drawing he could try to master. When Chris Maris, a young teacher, came to Queen's Mill in 1982, he was astonished by Stephen's drawings. Maris had been teaching disabled children for 9 years, but nothing he had ever seen had prepared him for Stephen. I was amazed by this little boy who sat on his own in a corner of the room drawing, he told me. Stephen used to draw and draw and draw and draw. The school called him the drawer. And they were the most unchildlike drawings, like St. Paul's and Tower Bridge and other London landmarks, in tremendous detail, when other children his age were just drawing stick figures. It was the sophistication of his drawings, their mastery of line and perspective, that amazed me. And these were all there when he was 7. Stephen was one of a group of 6 in Chris's class. He knew the names of all the others, Chris told me, but there was no sense of interaction or friendship with them. He was such an isolated little chap. But his native gift was so great, Chris felt, that he did not need to be taught in the ordinary way. He had apparently worked out by himself, or had an innate grasp of drawing techniques and perspective. Along with this, he showed a prodigious visual memory, which seemed able to take in the most complex buildings or cityscapes in a few seconds, and to hold them in mind in the minutest detail, indefinitely it seemed, and without the least apparent effort. Nor did the details need to be coherent to be integrated into a conventional structure. Among the most startling early drawings, Chris felt, were ones of demolition sites and earthquake scenes, with girders lying everywhere, exploded in all directions, everything in complete, almost random disarray. Yet Stephen remembered these scenes and drew them with the same fidelity and ease with which he drew classical models. It seemed to make no difference whether he drew from life or from the images in his memory. He needed no aide-memoire, no sketches or notes. A single sidelong glance lasting only a few seconds was enough. Stephen also showed abilities in spheres besides the visual. He was very good at mime, even before he was able to speak. He had an excellent memory for songs and would reproduce these with great accuracy. He could copy any movement to perfection. Thus Stephen, at 8, showed an ability to grasp, retain, and reproduce the most complex visual, auditory, motor, and verbal patterns, apparently irrespective of their context, significance, or meaning. It is characteristic of the savant memory, in whatever sphere, visual, musical, lexical, that it is prodigiously retentive of particulars. The large and small, the trivial and momentous, may be indifferently mixed, without any sense of salience, of foreground versus background. There is little disposition to generalize from these particulars, or to integrate them with each other, causally or historically, or with the self. In such a memory there tends to be an immovable connection of scene and time, of content and context, a so-called concrete situational or episodic memory, hence the astounding powers of literal recall so common in artistic savants, along with difficulty extracting the salient features from these particular memories, in order to build a general sense in memory. Thus the savant twins, calendrical calculators, whom I described in The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, while able to itemize every event of their lives from about their fourth year on, had no sense of their lives, of historical change as a whole. Such a memory structure is profoundly different from the normal and has both extraordinary strengths and extraordinary weaknesses. Jane Taylor MacDonald, author of News from the Border, a mother's memoir of her autistic son, says of her son, "Paul doesn't generalize the particulars of his experience into the habitual, the ongoing, as many most other people do. Each moment seems to stand out distinctly and almost unconnected with others in his mind. So nothing seems to get lost, repressed in the process." So it was, I often thought, with Stephen, whose life experience seemed to consist of vivid, isolated moments, unconnected with each other or with him, and so devoid of any deeper continuity or development. Though Stephen would draw incessantly, he did not seem to take any interest in the finished drawings, and Chris might find them in the wastebasket or just left on a desk. Stephen did not even seem to concentrate on his subject while he was drawing. Once, Chris related to me, Stephen was sitting opposite the Albert Memorial. He was doing a fabulous picture of that, but at the same time looking all around, at buses, the Albert Hall, whatever. Though he did not think that Stephen needed to be taught, Chris devoted himself as much as possible to Stephen and his drawing, providing him with models, with encouragement. This was not always easy because Stephen did not show much personal feeling. In a way, he was responsive to us, the adults. He would say, "Hello, Chris," or "Hello, Jean." But it was difficult to reach him, to know what was in his mind. He seemed not to understand different emotions and would laugh if one of the children had a temper tantrum or screamed. Stephen himself rarely had tantrums at school, but when he was little, he would sometimes have them at home. Chris was central in Stephen's life between 1982 and 1986. He would often take Stephen, along with his class, on outings in London to see St. Paul's, to feed the pigeons in Trafalgar Square, to see Tower Bridge being raised and lowered. These outings finally incited Stephen to words in his ninth year. He would recognize all the buildings and places they passed, traveling in the school bus, and excitedly call out their names. When he was six, he had learned to ask for paper when he needed it. For many years, he had not understood how to ask for anything, even by gesture or pointing. This, therefore, was not only one of his first words, but the first time he understood how to use words to address others. The social use of language, something normally achieved by the second year of life. There were some fears that if Stephen began to acquire language, he might lose his astounding visual gifts, as it happened, coincidentally or otherwise, with Nadia. But both Chris and Lorraine Cole felt that they had to do their utmost to enrich Stephen's life, to bring him from his wordless isolation into a world of interaction and language. They concentrated on making language more interesting, more relevant to Stephen, by linking it with the buildings and places he loved, and got him to draw a whole series of buildings based on letters of the alphabet. A for Albert Hall, B for Buckingham Palace, C for County Hall, and so on, right up to Z for London Zoo. Chris wondered if others would find Stephen's drawings as extraordinary as he did. Early in 1986, he entered two of them in the National Children's Art Exhibition. Both were exhibited, and one of them won a prize. Around this time, Chris also sought an expert opinion on Stephen's abilities from Beata Hermelin and Neil O'Connor, psychologists who were well known for their work on autistic savants. They found Stephen one of the most gifted savants they had ever tested, immensely proficient in both visual recognition and drawing from memory. On the other hand, he did rather poorly in general intelligence tests, scoring a verbal IQ of only 52. Word of Stephen's extraordinary talent started to spread. and arrangements were made to film him as part of a BBC program on savants titled The Foolish Wise Ones. Stephen took the filming very calmly, not at all fazed by cameras and crews, possibly even enjoying it slightly. He was asked to draw St. Pancras Station, a very Stephen building, as Lorraine Cole emphasized, elaborate, detailed, and incredibly complicated. The accuracy of his drawing is attested by a photograph taken at the same time. There is, however, a curious error. Stephen makes a mirror reversal of the clock and the whole top of the building. His accuracy was astounding, as were the speed with which he drew, the economy of line, the charm and style of his drawings. It was these that won viewers' hearts. The BBC program was shown in February of 1987 and aroused a storm of interest. Letters poured in asking where Stephen's drawings could be seen, and publishers offered contracts. Very soon, a collection of his work, to be called simply Drawings, was slated for publication, and it was this I received the proofs of in June of 1987. Stephen, only 13, was now famous throughout England, but as autistic, as disabled as ever. He could draw with the greatest ease any street he had seen, but he could not, unaided, cross one by himself. He could see all London in his mind's eye, but its human aspects were unintelligible to him. He could not maintain a real conversation with anyone, though increasingly he now showed a sort of pseudo-social conduct, talking to strangers in an indiscriminate and bizarre way. Chris had been away for some months in Australia and returned to find his young pupil famous, but he thought completely unchanged. He recognized that he'd been on TV and that he'd had a book published, but he didn't go overboard, as many children would have done. He wasn't affected. He was still the Stephen I knew. Stephen had not seemed to miss Chris too much during his absence, but seemed glad to see him back, said, "Hello, Chris," with a big smile on his face. None of this quite added up for me. Here was Stephen being exhibited as a significant artist. The former president of the Royal Academy of Art, Sir Hugh Casson, had called him possibly the best child artist in Britain. But Chris and others, even the most sympathetic, seemed to see him as greatly lacking in both intellect and identity. The tests that had been given to him seemed to confirm the severity of his emotional and intellectual defect. Was there, nonetheless, a mental and personal dimension, a depth and sensibility in him that could emerge, if nowhere else, in his art? Was not art quintessentially an expression of a personal vision, a self? Could one be an artist without having a self? All these questions had been in my mind since I had first seen Stephen's pictures, and I was eager to meet him. The opportunity came in February of 1988, when Stephen came to New York, accompanied by Chris, to make another television documentary. Stephen had been in New York for a couple of days, seeing and drawing the sights of the city, and his greatest thrill, flying over it in a helicopter. I thought he might like to see City Island, the little island off New York where I live, and invited him to come to my house. He and Chris arrived in the middle of a snowstorm. Stephen was a demure, grave little black boy, though clearly with an impish side. He looked young to me, closer to 10 than 13, with a smallish head tilted to one side. He reminded me somewhat of the autistic children I had seen before, with a head-nodding mannerism or tic and some odd flapping movements of the hands. He never looked at me directly, but seemed to glance at me, briefly, out of the corners of his eyes. I asked him how he was finding New York, and he said, "Very nice," with a strong Cockney accent. I have little recollection of his saying much else. He tended to be very quiet, almost mute. But his language had developed a good deal since the early days, and there were times, Chris said, when he would get excited and almost babble. He had been very excited on the plane. He had never flown before. And, Chris told me, talked with the cabin crew and other passengers, showing his book around on the flight. Stephen wanted to show me his latest drawings of New York. They were all in a portfolio Chris was carrying, and I admired them, especially the aerial ones he had done from the helicopter, as he showed them to me. He nodded emphatically as he displayed them, calling some of them good and nice. He seemed to have no sense of either vanity or modesty, but showed me his drawings, commented on them in an ingenuous way, and with a total absence of self-consciousness. After he had shown me these, I asked him if he would draw something for me, perhaps my house. He nodded, and we wandered outside. It was snowing, cold and wet. Not a day to linger. Stephen bestowed a quick, indifferent look at my house. There hardly seemed to be any active attention. Glanced then at the rest of the road and the sea at the end of the road, then asked to come in. As he took up his pen and started drawing, I held my breath. "Don't worry," Chris broke in. "You can talk at the top of your voice if you want to. It won't make any difference. You can't interrupt him. He could concentrate if the house was falling down." Stephen did not make any sketch or outline, but just started at one edge of the paper. I had a feeling he might have started anywhere at all, and steadily moved across it as if transcribing some tenacious inner image or visualization. As he was putting in the porch railings, Chris remarked, "I didn't see any of that detail there." "No," said Stephen, his expression implying, "No, you wouldn't." Stephen had not studied the house, had made no sketches, had not drawn it from life, but had, in a brief glance, taken everything in, extracted its essence, seen every detail, held it all in his memory, and then, in a single swift line, drawn it. And I did not doubt that. Had we let him, he could have drawn the entire street. Stephen's drawing was accurate in some ways, but took various liberties in others. He gave my house a chimney where there was none, but omitted the three fir trees in front of the house, the picket fence around it, and the neighboring houses. He focused on the house to the exclusion of anything else. It has often been said that savants have photographic or eidetic memories, but as I photocopied Stephen's drawing, I thought how unlike a Xerox machine he was. His pictures in no sense resembled copies or photographs, something mechanical and impersonal. There were always additions, subtractions, revisions, and, of course, Stephen's unmistakable style. They were images and showed us some of the immensely complex neural processes that are needed to make a visual and graphic image. Stephen's drawings were individual constructions, but could they be seen in a deeper sense as creations? His drawings, like those of my patient Jose, had a closeness to the actual, a literalness and naivete. Clara Park, the mother of an autistic artist, has called this an unusual capacity to render the object as perceived, not conceived. She also writes of an unusual capacity for delayed rendition, as characteristic of savant artists. This indeed was very striking in Stephen, who after a single glance at a building would retain it effortlessly for days or weeks, and then draw it as if from life. Sir Hugh Casson wrote in his introduction to drawings, "Unlike most children, who tend to draw less from direct observation than from symbols or images seen secondhand, Stephen Wiltshire draws exactly what he sees, no more, no less. Artists are full of symbols and images seen secondhand and bring to their drawings not only the conventions of representation they acquired as children, but the entire history of Western art. It may be necessary to leave these behind, to leave behind even the primal category of objecthood. As Monet put it, whenever you go out to paint, try to forget what objects you have in front of you, a tree, a house, a field, or whatever. Merely think, here is a little squeeze of blue, here an oblong of pink, here a streak of yellow, and paint it just as it looks to you, the exact color and shape, until it gives your own naive impression of the scene before you." But Stephen, if Casson is right, and Jose, and Nadia, and other savants, may not have to make such deconstructions. may not have to relinquish such constructs because, at many levels, from the neural to the cultural, they never made them in the first place, or made them to a far smaller extent. In this way, their situation is radically different from that of the normal, though this does not mean that they cannot be artists too. I started to wonder, too, about the relationships in Stephen's life, how important they were, to what extent they had developed in the face of his autism and devastating early loss. His relationship with Chris Maris, perhaps the most crucial during his last 5 years at Queensmill, had threatened to end when in July of 1987, Stephen had to leave Queensmill for a secondary school. For a while, Chris had arranged to continue seeing Stephen on weekends, to take him on drawing outings around London, and even on his first trips to New York and Paris. But by May 1989, these expeditions had come to an end, and Stephen seemed to lack the initiative to do much drawing on his own. It seemed as if he needed another person to get him going, to facilitate his drawing. Whether he missed or mourned Chris in a more personal way was far less clear. When I later spoke of Chris to Stephen, he would talk about him always as Chris Maris or Mr. Maris in a very flat and factual way, without any apparent emotion. A normal child would be deeply distressed at the loss of someone who had been so close for many years, but no such distress was apparent in Stephen. I wondered if he was repressing painful feelings, or distancing himself from them. But I was not sure whether, in his autistic way, he even had any personal emotion here at all. Christopher Gilberg writes of a 15-year-old autistic boy whose mother had died of cancer. Asked how he was doing, the boy replied, "Oh, I am all right. You see, I have Asperger syndrome, which makes me less vulnerable to the loss of loved ones than are most people." Stephen, of course, would never have been able to articulate his inner state in this way. And yet one had to wonder whether he took the loss of Chris with some of the same flatness as Gilberg's young patient, and whether such a flatness might not characterize most of the human relationships in his life. Into this void erupted Margaret Hewson. Margaret had been Stephen's literary agent since the BBC program 2 years before, and had developed an increasing personal and artistic interest in him. I had first met her in 1988, when with Stephen we roved around London on a drawing expedition. Margaret and Stephen, it was evident to me, got on very well. Stephen, though perhaps incapable at this point of any depth of feeling or caring, nevertheless showed strong instinctive responses to different people. He had taken to Margaret from the start, attracted, I think, by her enormous energy and impetus, the exhilarating whirlwind atmosphere she seemed to create all around her, and by her obvious feeling for him and his art. Margaret seemed to know everyone and have been everywhere, and perhaps this gave Stephen a sense of a larger world, of horizons far beyond the narrow ones that had confined his life hitherto. Margaret finally was very knowledgeable about art, a knowledge that extended from art history to the technical details of drawing. In the fall of 1989, Margaret began obtaining drawing commissions for Stephen and taking him out drawing every weekend, along with her husband and partner in the literary agency, Andrew. She instantly abolished the use of tracing paper and rulers, such as he had used for some of the drawings in his second book, Cities, published in 1989, and insisted he draw freehand in ink. One can learn the value of a line only by going straight into ink and making mistakes, she declared. Under Margaret's impetus and guidance, Stephen started to draw regularly once again, and to draw more boldly than he had ever done. And yet, even in Cities, there had been some extraordinary freehand improvisations, imaginary cities which Stephen had conceived, conflating the features of several real ones. After a morning of traveling and drawing, they would all return to the Hewson house for lunch, where they would often be joined by the Houston's daughter, Annie, only a few years older than Stephen. He seemed to look forward to these outings and would become excited on Sunday mornings, waiting for Margaret and Andrew to collect them. For their part, the Hewsons felt a real affection for Stephen, even though they were not sure he felt any actual affection for them. They started taking him on occasional longer excursions, a trip to Salisbury, and 2 weekends in Scotland. Stephen's obvious fondness for the visual effects of water, he lived near a canal in London and would sometimes walk along it with his mother or sister and do little sketches of the boats and locks, suggested to Margaret a theme for a new book. Together they would visit cities built around canals, floating cities, Venice, Amsterdam, and Leningrad, and draw these. Late in the fall of 1989, Margaret impulsively phoned up Mrs. Wiltshire and suggested that Stephen and his sister Annette come to Venice with them for their Christmas holiday. The trip went exceedingly well. Stephen, now 15, seemed to cope easily with the uncertainties of travel, which would have thrown him only a few years before. He portrayed, as Margaret hoped he might, St. Mark's, the Doge's Palace, the great monuments of Venetian culture, and obviously enjoyed drawing them. But when asked what he thought of Venice, after a week in this high point of European civilization, he could only say, "I prefer Chicago." And this not because of its buildings, but its American cars. Stephen had a passion for these, and could identify, name, and draw every post-war model ever made in the United States. A few weeks later, plans were made for his next trip to Amsterdam. Stephen approved of the trip for a very specific reason. He had seen photographs of the city and said, "I prefer Amsterdam to Venice because it has cars." Once again, Stephen captured perfectly the feeling of the city from his formal drawings on the Westerkerk and the Begijnhof to his tiny, charming sketch of an odd statue with a street organ. Stephen seemed very much alive and in high humor in Amsterdam, and started to show new aspects of himself. Lorraine Cole, who came along on the trip, was particularly startled at the changes she saw. When he was little, nothing was amusing to Stephen. He now finds all manner of things funny, and his laughter is incredibly infectious. He has gone back to caricaturing people around him, and he takes great pleasure watching his victims' reactions. One evening in Amsterdam, when Stephen was due to give an interview for a television show, Margaret developed a severe attack of asthma and had to stay in her hotel room. Stephen was very distressed, refused to do the TV show, and could not be budged from the end of Margaret's bed. "I'm going to stay with you till you get better," he declared. "You're not going to die." Margaret and Andrew were very touched by this. "This was the first time we saw that he cared," she told me. Was it possible that Stephen was starting to show some belated personal development in spite of his autism? Intrigued by Margaret's report on the Amsterdam trip, I arranged to come along on the next visit to Moscow and Leningrad, planned for May of 1990. I flew to London, met Stephen and Margaret there, and did some testing with Stephen. These tests, devised by Uta Frith and her colleagues, require one to react to various cartoons, some of which relate simple sequences of events, while others cannot be understood without attributing different intentions, perspectives, beliefs, or states of mind, and sometimes dissemblings to the characters involved. Stephen, it was clear, had a very limited ability to imagine other states of mind. Frith writes that one researcher carried out an informal survey in America using cartoons from The New Yorker. Very able and highly educated autistic people failed to understand them or find them funny. I also gave him a large jigsaw puzzle, which he put together very swiftly. I then gave him a second puzzle, this time face down, so that he did not have the picture to assist him. He did this just as quickly as the first. The picture, meaning, it seemed, was not necessary to him. What was preeminent and spectacular was his ability to apprehend a large number of abstract shapes and to see in a trice how they fitted together. Such performances are characteristic of autistic people, who also excel in tests of block design, and especially in finding embedded figures. Thus the psychologist Lynn Waterhouse, testing one visual savant, J.D., who as a boy his parents said was able to complete a 500-piece jigsaw puzzle in about 2 minutes, and thereafter had to be given 5,000-piece puzzles, found he performed phenomenally well on almost every visual perception test she could give him. On tests of line orientation, visual gestalt closure, block design, and so on, he obtained nearly perfect results, in each case performing the tests at many times the normal rate. Stephen, like J.D., had prodigious powers of abstract pattern recognition and visual analysis. But this alone could not explain his drawing. J.D., despite his perceptual powers, was not especially gifted in drawing. Stephen then was calling on another sort of power, of vivid representation. Representation that created an external form for his perceptions, and that bore a very recognizable and personal style. Whether this power of representation entailed any depth of inner resonance or response remained completely unclear. Given Stephen's powers of abstract visual analysis, how important was meaning to him? How much did he get the meaning of what he drew? And how much did it matter whether he did or not? I showed Stephen a portrait by Matisse and asked if he would draw it. Margaret and Andrew are very fond of Matisse, and it was a print of theirs that I showed Stephen. He drew it from the original, swiftly and confidently. It was not wholly literally accurate, but it was very Matisse-like. When I asked him to draw it again from memory an hour later, he drew it differently, and another hour after this, yet differently again. But all his drawings, he did 5 in all, while different in detail, were strikingly evocative of the original. In some sense, therefore, Stephen had extracted the drawing's Matisse-ness, had permuted it various ways, and had made this central in all his copies. Was this purely formal, cognitive, a matter of getting Matisse's style in a formulaic way? Or was he responding at a deeper level to Matisse's vision, his sensibility and art? I asked Stephen if he remembered my house, which he had visited more than 2 years before, and if he would draw it again for me. He nodded and again drew the house, but with various revisions. He now gave it one lower window instead of 2. He removed a pillar from the porch and made the steps more prominent. He kept the fictitious chimney, and now he added a fictitious American flag and a tall flagstaff as well. I think he felt these as the ingredients of a formulary American house. Thus the Matisse and my house were conceived and represented in a variety of versions. In both cases he got the style at once, and his later drawings were improvisations within this style. After all this testing, I was still bewildered. Stephen seemed so defective and so gifted simultaneously. Were his defects and his gifts totally separate, or were they at a deeper level integrally related? Were there qualities like autistic literalness and concreteness that might in some contexts be gifts, in others deficits? The tests also gave me a feeling of disquiet, as if I had spent days reducing Stephen to defects and gifts and not seeing him as a human being, as a whole. I had just reread Uta Frith's book, Autism, explaining the enigma, and wrote to her, "Tomorrow I go with Stephen to Russia. I have seen something of his odd skills and defects. I have yet to see him as a mind and person. Perhaps a week of being with him will show me this." With these hopes, then, I set out with Stephen for Russia. Sitting at Gatwick Airport, waiting for our flight, I was impressed by his deep concentration. He sat enthralled with the magazine Classic Cars. He looked at the pictures with extraordinary intentness. He did not raise his head from the magazine for more than 20 minutes. Occasionally he bent closer to inspect a detail. What he saw, I thought, would be forever imprinted on his cortex. Once in a while he suddenly laughed. What in this abstract exercise excited his amusement? In flight, Stephen immersed himself in a drawing of Balmoral, after studying a postcard of the castle. He was oblivious of the conversations going on around him, the magnificent landscapes and seascapes below. At Moscow airport, Stephen, very quiet, looked at the cars, yellow cabs and black Zills with license plates starting with MK. A hideous smell of unrefined gas hung over the airport. Stephen sniffed, wrinkled his nose. He is extremely sensitive to smells. As we drove into the city at 2 a.m., we saw tall, silvery birches by the side of the road, and an immense, low moon. Even Stephen, seemingly oblivious of his surroundings before, gazed at the vast, moonlit landscape with delight, his nose pressed against the cold window of the bus. The next morning, as we walked around Red Square, Stephen was actively curious, taking snapshots, peering at buildings, struck by their novelty. Other people turned around and stared at him in the street. Black people, apparently, were unusual in Moscow. He found a spot from which he wanted to draw the Spassky Tower, and had Margaret set a stool in precisely this place. Not there or there, but here, passive in so many ways, he was entirely master now. In the middle of Red Square, he was a tiny figure, wearing a fur cap and navy blue woolen gloves. Dozens of tourists swarmed around in the brilliant May sun. Many of them peered at Stephen's drawing. Stephen ignored them, or was unconscious of them, and drew on undisturbed. He hummed to himself as he drew, holding his pen characteristically awkwardly, childishly, between his third and fourth fingers. At one point he broke into giggles and laughter. But this, it turned out, was because a scene in Rain Man, "Don't you dare drive," he said, kept entering his mind. Margaret sat to one side as he drew, encouraging, "Good, clever boy," advising him on aesthetic points and architectural details. At her suggestion, for instance, Stephen examined the tower's crenellation. She is almost a collaborator in a way, and though his talent is so personal and indigenous, he clearly looks to her for affectionate and always affirmative comments. Later we visited the History Museum, an eclectic red brick building designed by an English architect. Margaret instructed Stephen, "Have a jolly good look at that building, study it. Take in the vocabulary of that building now. I want you to draw it from memory afterward." But what Stephen actually drew later was different from the History Museum and bore half a dozen onion domes, not present in the original. I first wondered whether this was a defect of memory and asked him if he would draw St. Basil's from memory. He did this instantly, a very accurate and quite charming sketch, in all of 2 minutes. Later in the day, he started a drawing of the vast shopping arcade at Goom, which he finished at leisure over a Coke in the hotel. He had retained by memory even the shop signs, although they were to him unintelligible Cyrillic letters. There was no faulting his memory, clearly. Margaret and I tried to think what had happened with the History Museum. Stephen was distracted when asked to memorize it. The police in Red Square made him nervous, and when asked how he felt about it, would only say, "It's all right," which meant he did not like it. He tried to make it more attractive, I think, by crowning it with onion domes. But these were so out of keeping with the base that the resulting building looked hardly possible. The next morning, as we met for breakfast in the hotel dining room, Stephen greeted me with a booming, "Hello, Oliver," shouted with great friendliness and warmth, or so I thought. But then I was not sure. Was it merely a social automatism? The great neurologist Kurt Goldstein wrote of another autistic boy. He becomes fond of some people. At the same time, however, his emotional responses and human attachments remain shallow and perfunctory. Meeting him at intervals of several months, one is welcomed and bid goodbye with the same impersonal kindness as if contact were only real as long as it lasted during concrete presence. It is a presence without emotional content. At an in-tourist shop, I bought a piece of amber. Stephen glanced at it indifferently. It held no visual appeal for him, until I rubbed it and showed him how it became electrically charged. It attracted tiny pieces of paper now, so that when I put the amber a few inches away, they suddenly flew up to it. His eyes opened wide in astonishment. He took the amber from me and repeated the electrification by himself. But then his wonder seemed to fade. He did not ask what happened or why, and he seemed uninterested when I explained it. I was excited at seeing his initial astonishment. I had never seen him truly astonished before, but then it faded, died out, and this to me seemed rather ominous. At dinner, chortling, Stephen drew a cartoon of us on the table with himself fanning me. I am sensitive to heat and always carry a Japanese fan, which he had often seen me use. He portrayed me as cowering under the impact of the fan, and himself as large, powerful, in command. This was a symbolic representation, the first one I had seen him make. Traveling, living with Stephen, we had now been together for 5 days, I became very conscious of how brittle he was, physiologically, of the profound fluctuations in his state. There were times when he was animated and interested in his surroundings, and could do brilliant, funny impersonations and cartoons. And there were times when he would revert to the deepest autism and respond, if at all, like an automaton, echolalically. Such fluctuations, usually lasting a few hours, rarely days, are common in children with classical autism, though their cause is not understood. They had been much worse, I was told, when Stephen was younger. The next day we boarded a train for the day-long journey to Leningrad. Margaret had put together a huge hamper of provisions, more than enough for ourselves and any fellow passengers in the compartment. As the train got underway, we started with an early breakfast. We had left the hotel at 5 to make this early train. As she unpacked the basket, Stephen, half convulsively, swooped his head and sniffed everything as it came out. I was reminded of some of my post-encephalitic patients, and some people with Tourette syndrome, whom I had also seen with olfactory behaviors of this sort. I suddenly realized that Stephen's smell world might be as vivid as his visual one, but we do not have the language, the means, to convey such a world. Stephen gazed uncertainly at our hard-boiled eggs. Was it possible that he had never cracked one open? Playfully, I took one and cracked it on my head. Stephen was delighted and burst out laughing. He had never seen a hard-boiled egg cracked in this way, and he gave me a second egg to see if I would do it again, and then, reassured, cracked one on his own head. There was something spontaneous in this egg cracking, and I think Stephen felt easier with me after this, because I had shown him how playful, how silly I could be. After breakfast, Stephen and I played some word games. He was quite good at I Spy, and when I prompted him with I Spy with my little eye something beginning with C, he quickly reeled off coat,